Hi, and welcome to The Curve Podcast. My name is Andrew F. Pierce, and this podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Perth, Western Australia. Sovereignty never ceded. There is space in this bluey-obsessed world for two Aussie-animated canine stories, with Alexis Stadelman's utterly delightful and wonderfully inventive series 100% Wolf following the exploits of one Freddie Lupin, a werewolf who turns into a puffy pink poodle when the moon comes out. Kicking off in 2019 with the bright and brilliant 100% Wolf, which saw Freddie at odds with his pack as he had to prove that he had the heart of a wolf, a hugely successful TV series spawned. Following the story of Freddie, his bouffant friend Betty, a slightly loopy Papillon, and Hamish, a dottery old West Highland White Terrier, and their group of misfit friends. In 2024, we've been treated to the feature film sequel, 200% Wolf, which sees Freddy accidentally conjuring up a cheeky moon sprite named Moopoo. With the cosmic order in jeopardy and a new villain to deal with, Freddy, Batty and Hamish must return Moopoo to the moon or else the world will be thrown out of order. There's a joyous charm to the 100% Wolf series that shines with each frame. A lot of the brilliance comes down to the voice work of Eli Swindles, who plays Freddy, Samara Weaving, who voices Batty in the film series, and Akmal Saleh, who voices Hamish. Joining them this time round for 200% Wolf and relishing every moment that she gets is Jennifer Saunders, who plays the witchy Max. Where 100% Wolf entertained with its surprising narrative twists and turns, 200% Wolf stuns with a brightness that harnesses all the colours of the rainbows to become one of the most gloriously expressive animated films ever produced in Australia. 200% Wolf is Pixar-level animated work, and the team utilise every moment to show just how great Australian animation can really be. Matching that level of high-quality animation is a story that truly delights with a playfulness and a comedic verve that will have adults and kids laughing their jocks off. Look, I'm a big fan of a great fart joke, and 200% Wolf features a wealth of toot-scooting titters. This pitch-perfect comedy elevates the heart of the film, making the story of Moopoo an endearing and charming one that is guaranteed to have everyone shed a tear or two due to how utterly charming and sweet this little celestial creation is. Look, I'm in awe of how great 200% Wolf is. It is an absolute joy from start to finish and is guaranteed to delight kids of all ages. Its joy is beyond belief and acts as an antidote to the sea of dark family films out there. See this on the biggest screen that you can. Thank me later. I was able to chat with Alexis Stadelman and star Eli Swindles prior to the film's world premiere at the Sydney Film Festival, and I got to ask both of them about the delight of a fart joke in a film. My chat with Alex does touch on some slight spoilers, but it's nothing that would impact your enjoyment of the film. 200% Wolf has one more screening at the Sydney Film Festival on the 15th of June, and a wide release will come later in the year. Once again, see it on big screen. I'm looking forward to seeing it again. For now, here is the trailer for 200% Wolf, followed by Eli Swindles talking about introducing the film at the world premiere, and the chat with Alexis follows after that. I should also add as well that if you enjoy what we do, please head over to thecurb.com.au to listen to other interviews and to read reviews, and head over to patreon.com/thecurb.au to help support us keep us ad-free from as little as $1 a month.
Catastrophe was averted tonight.
Come on!
By what appears to be a tiny pink poodle.
Ow.
I want the pack to take me seriously.
Hello?
Hello.
What are you doing?
Summoning the spirit?
Freddy?
I'm a wolf! Look at these guns! You're a baby moon spirit?
Sure. Oh, boy.
You summoned the spirit?
Ta-da!
Spirits aren't made for this world. Moopoo's inner light will fade out.
What have I done?
Nice one, big bad wolf.
We need to save Moopoo.
Next stop, the Great Mist!
Ooh, visitors.
Huh? I hate visitors.
Ladies and gentlemen, Armageddon's upon us.
Save the baby!
He just loved that guy.
Whoa!
Did we just get mooned by a moon spirit?
Nice one, Moopoo.
Yeah, I got to introduce the film, so I shared a bunch of stories on the gram, and, you know, that's a real highlight for me. I've never introduced a feature film in my life at the world premiere. Yeah, and Sydney Film Festival are just such a nice team, and I don't know, I just had a really good time, like, you know, doing the whole red carpet moment and everything. It was a nice turnout. There were all these kids there dressed in pink and everything, so yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, because I love that kind of the colours of the series and the films, you know, are just so bright and beautiful. And it's got to be great to see kids and adults all getting into the vibe of it. But you're talking about like Samara and Jennifer both being great, but you're particularly great as well. Like it's been great to see you kind of evolve as a character with the series and the films. It's been interesting to see how it goes. As you're saying, like 6 years to get this made, it's quite a chunk of time. How have you felt having been able to sit with Freddie as a character and build him up as a character over these years?
I feel like he's a nice part of me now, and I feel like a very sort of honored responsibility because, you know, Finn, the writer, he's obviously very talented what he does. He wrote the first and the second film, but and I think he writes, you know, a chunk of the Eps as well. But, you know, a lot of the times when we get in there, because there's so much room to play, when I'm with Alex, the director, like, I do a lot of improv, you know, like, I make stuff up on the fly, and we throw, like, even if it's a weird, you know, noise or sound or just things from the zeitgeist that we can, like, slip in, you know, that will make sense in a read, like, you do that, you know, and, like, yeah, I love doing that. That's the freedom that animation has that acting on camera cannot have, because I don't know, I think that's why something like, it's a different genre or ball game, but stuff like The Simpsons or The Family Guy reads so well with people, because the places that they can go in animation is just way crazier, because it's not real life, you know, like you can just totally be very, very abstract and like completely obscure and just, you know, weird with your references and how you read something, because I don't know, it's not necessarily like it goes over their heads, but like they don't judge as much. They're not like, you know, holding a magnifying glass up with things and being like, oh, that wasn't believable or that wasn't realistic. Because you're like, no, well, why the hell would it be? We're in a freaking animated environment. Like, this is not real life. So even little things, like a good example of on the series, season 2, Book of Hearts, when we were doing it a few years ago, there was a line where like Freddie was insulted by like some, one of the characters or something like that. And so I just like threw in the sort of reading of like saying, you know, what kids do and what people do is like where you just go read, like, you know what I mean? It's just like a rude period. That's it. And I'm like, the line's not written in there, but you know, like, because I know who this person is now so well and I can just do him at the drop of a hat, like, I don't know, it's a real blessing, because you can just throw things out that you know will work. And it is a little, like, not tiresome, but I guess it's a different cross to bear when, like, you're the hero of every story, and even in, like, an animated sense, like, kind of... You do have a sort of like rigmarole, like journey that you need to go on, and you're not always the most beloved character. Like, it's usually like the sidekicks, like Ivan from the series, or like Akmal, who plays the shepherd dog in, you know, the films, who have all the funny lines and everything and the throwaway lines on the side. But because we're always focused on like the protagonist getting to where he or she needs to be, like, you kind of have this weight where you're just like, oh, okay, no, and I do need to keep the story rolling, and I can't be too, you know, crazy. But I think, yeah, that's where the series takes a lot of like risks, I think, as well. Like, we throw out so many jokes, so many references, and yeah, it's funny, like, even though the demographic is for who it is, but you know, it doesn't mean that you can't have fun with like just how you read things. And yeah, I don't know, it's the little things for me. Like, he genuinely makes me laugh. And I think the writers are so intelligent with how they bring the worlds and stitch everything together. Like, it's just, it's such a ball. And any actor who gets to be on the animation, and I said this when I introduced the film last night, they know what a blessing it is, because you rock up, you look however you look, you know you're not going to be on camera, and you just sit in that room and you just yell and scream and kick and do all these crazy dumb things like Wallace sounds. And animation is really cool too, in the sense where there's no personal sort of feelings that we need to be careful of with like directing actors. That's what I love about it too. Like, when you're acting on camera, the way a director usually sort of directs you is very cautious and measured, and they do it in a way to not sort of ever give you a line reading or hurt your feelings or whatever, which is fine. And that's, you know, the semantics, and that's how it should be, sort of thing, I guess, because, you know, you can't give people line readings. But in an animation, because it's so married up with how things need to be animated, there's no space for you to feel sensitive about, oh, that line wasn't right or whatever, because they're literally going, so storyboards, he's going to be on this staircase at this point, and he needs to fall, laugh, scream, cry, yelp, and then be on the floor in like 30 seconds. So you kind of need to have this full voila silly journey, and I need you to hit all these marks, and yeah, just do that, please. And if you can just sort of laugh it off at the end, that's great. Okay, yeah, cool, it's a clear task. Let me see if I can give it a crack and like actually do it.
One of the things which I've always enjoyed about kids films is that it's the rare space that a fart joke is, you're guaranteed a fart joke somewhere in there, and it's a very safe space for a fart joke. And 200% Wolf has some really great fart joke stuff in there. I'm curious, for you as a performer, how much fun a fart joke is.
Yeah, I mean, it's never not funny, you know, like the fart in church. It's funny anywhere it happens. It just breaks the seriousness of the moment. It breaks the intensity. Literally, it's an icebreaker, right? Yeah, I forgot about all that stuff. See, that's what I mean. You know, when you do it so long ago, you watch it and you're like, oh my God, you know? And like the lullaby moment, like I was like, wow, I forgot singing that. I forgot doing all that. Like, it's just nice to see it all up there. The music, the scoring was really amazing this time too. I feel like it really just went into Hans Zimmer levels. I was like, man, this is just transcending now.
I want to kind of step back just a little bit as well and look at your foundation as an animator and where that interest in animation came from. What was the initial kind of sparking point for you to say, this is where I want my career to go?
Ooh, well, I've never actively really thought of becoming an animator, because as a child, for me, animation was something that is on television. I never associated that with humans actually making that actual somebody made that, you know, it never crossed my mind. But and then I was about to finish school, and I was a little, yeah, but I felt a bit lost in terms of what I wanted to do, because growing, like getting a job was a grown-up thing to do, and I was a kind of dyslexic artist. And and I found a piece of paper in the street, and for some reason I picked it up and it unfolded it and said, like, it was an application for an internship as an animator in a 2D company. And I went, that's a good idea. I'll give it a go. And I went there and did a test, and it was a very small animation company with literally 10 employees, so everybody had to do every job. But I did the test, and but then the boss turns around and he said, I don't have a job for you though, but if something comes up, I'll give you a call. And this guy gets up and he said, well, I think you might have a job for him because I resign. And he literally held out his pencil and he said he can have my job. And and it was like a funny triangle. I was standing there looking at the pencil the guy's holding up, looking at the boss, looking at the guy. The boss is looking at the guy, looking at me, looking at the pencil, and we all looked at each other and the pencil. And then I just reached out and took the pencil. I'm looking at the boss as if saying, like, is that okay? And he went, I guess so. And that's how I got into animation.
That's probably one of the most unique this is how I started stories I've ever heard. Yeah.
it was a great moment, and I'm very, very happy and lucky that it happened. So yeah.
And then like having a look through the work that you've done, you did a bunch of work with Disney Productions and both TV and then the direct-to-video stuff as well. What was that kind of foundation like for you, getting to work amongst these kinds of great names and great characters as well?
Look, we're all like grown up with Disney as like the benchmark and the holy grail of animation, and especially the old movies done by the seven old men, the animators. They were just, for me, like, I've watched Jungle Book over and over as a child, or Pinocchio and all these movies, and to be then able to work on some of the sequels to that was just incredible. And I ended up meeting Ollie Johnson and Frank Thomas, my absolute animation heroes. And I chatted with Frank Thomas a whole afternoon, and we cried together, and it was really an amazing, amazing day. But yeah, so that always meant a lot to me, but not just the opportunity to work on some of the classics that I've grown up with, and I really felt like we did it we paid a pretty good homage to it by really trying to make very good quality animation and everything. But also for me, working at Disney, it gave me a really good foundation, my drawing skills, or like we've spent so much time doing live drawings and really like honing our skills year after year after year. And we brought dogs into the studio and we spent days drawing dogs for a movie, for example. And we even had somebody come in to speak to us about the anatomy of dogs, how the bones work, how the cartilage works, everything to be able to create believable movement. And I think that foundation has really helped me really create a believable universe, really. And I wouldn't change it for anything.
I mean, it's huge. I do recall seeing, like, as a kid growing up, I was enamored by animation as well, like everybody is and stuff. And I remember watching behind the scenes stuff off, like, I think it was the Lion King, and then also 101 Dalmatians. Both of those have that kind of the footage of seeing the animators learning from seeing the actual physical animals. I'm curious, you're talking about the crew going out and looking at Fremantle and stuff like that. Did you do that kind of stuff, bring in dogs for 100% and 200% Wolf?
With this movie, we didn't really have that luxury, but having had that really strong background of having studied dogs to such an nth degree, I parted that information with the team, and often explained if somebody made a dog jump up onto a box, I said, well, no, a dog doesn't do that. They shift their weight first to the back legs and then spring up. And by doing that, it made the movement more believable, because otherwise it's just something on four legs. Even the weight of the animal makes a big difference in terms of how they move. That was important.
And I imagine it's probably equally important, even though you're dealing with fantastical things like werewolves and magic and stuff like that, there is still that need to have that grounded aspect, and I imagine that comes down to the physicality of things. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. because without it, I don't think the characters feel believable enough. And it's funny, it's actually easier to get away with animals than humans. It's, like, if humans are very cartoony, you can get away with more things. But if you ever work on a movie where humans are have human proportions and are acting quite realistic, we all are observing each other all the time. So if somebody walks a bit, if that walk cycle isn't right, or that the stand isn't right, where the weight shifts from one hip to the other hip, we see that. And it doesn't, you don't have to study humans like consciously, but we all notice when it's wrong. We don't notice when it's right, when it's animated well, but when it's animated wrong, we notice. And that's when people say like, ooh, didn't like the animation, I can't put my finger on it. Why? But, you know, this is why. Yeah, the study of what you draw is very important.
So with that in mind, like you, as we were saying before, you've got the you know, storyboards behind you. You've got that physical thing, the characters as well. How much of that previs process, where does like the previs process play into the creative process of making the film, and like 3D printing characters and stuff like that? How does that kind of step into the process of it all?
Yeah, that 3D print came a little late. Generally, I would have loved to have people have those on their desks. But, you know, with a 3D world, we do actually have spinning versions that people can just watch to remind themselves of how they look like in all angles. But also we create with each character we create first a range of motion and specific expressions that work with a specific character, because, you know, like some characters don't, they act in a certain way, they're more angry, or, you know, we make sure that their eyebrows work really well. But somebody like Mupu, you don't have to concentrate so much on the eyebrows, because if you ever notice, toddlers, when they frown, there's very... Most toddlers don't even have eyebrows to start with. So yeah, we specifically create each model in a way that it particularly works with the kind of age of the character, the character traits, and the range of motion of their movements as well. So... Yeah.
It's so fascinating to see that kind of process as well. And I'm curious then, when, like, you've got Finn who's writing the script for this one, what kind of step did you get him into do the script for it? Where did he flow into it?
He was involved right from the start, because I have a great working relationship with Finn. We've done a few movies together now, and he's one of the most unprecious writers, because some writers they like to, you know, he's not precious, but he's also a very collaborative writer, because some writers they just want to go away and live in their own world and write something and then present you with a finished script, which you then can give notes on, of course, but they don't like bouncing back and forth too much. And what I really enjoy with Finn is we sat down for a few afternoons over a period of time where we just thought about stories. What's the kind of story that we want to tell that fits into this universe? And what kind of characters do we want to create to add to these stories? And really, what's the theme? And from that, we slowly came up with about five different ideas, which we then circulated with the producers, and there was definitely the clear winner of involving the moon spirits, which really helped for me to expand the universe of the werewolves, because, you know, like, the moon means so much to werewolves. Everybody knows that, and we want to take a quirky edge on that, and how does this actually work? And, you know, and hence Mupu ended up being created, and And Finn is actually the father of the two toddlers that I based Poo Poo on.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well, that's it. So there's that nice personal touch as well. I'm curious then, like with the series, how do you make sure that you're not overstepping stuff that had already been established in the series or build upon that as well?
Ooh, well, that's a difficult one because I do kind of see the series almost as a standalone. Like this movie, I really wanted to basically carry on straight from the first movie, because Freddy has finally, you know, been accepted as part of the pack, even though he's a poodle. But now in this movie, we would take it one step further. So what does that mean now that he's part of the pack, and how does he fit in, and that want of you know, gaining respect from everybody else. To be honest, so with that series, we don't fully take too much of that into account in our storytelling. But of course, you know, like with Finn being, you know, the writer across the series as well, there were definitely certain things we avoided doing because they're already similar storylines in the TV show. So yeah, but we didn't want to really be guided too much by all the nuances of the TV show, because it is it's an adjacent universe.
Yeah. And you don't also probably want to have the audience feel like I've got to do some, not homework as such, but
yeah,
can also sometimes be the feeling of it. I'm curious then as well, like having worked in animation, you know, in the 90s, what have you seen change since then to now? Like, how is the stories for kids, and obviously the style of animation has changed, but how's the storytelling for kids and families changed since then?
I feel these days there's a lot more onus on comedy in animated movies. And the pace, I guess, movies of the 90s or prior to the 90s, that there's always been a slower pace and an unfolding of the story, but I also feel like a bit more simplistic in terms of the depth of the characters. I think we now pack a lot more kind of history into the characters to make them feel like a fuller character with a past that affects the presents and therefore their wants for the futures, and I think it is kind of become a little bit more sophisticated, I would say, in terms of the amount of story we pack into it. But most of all, I think, yeah, comedy. If you try to sell an animated movie, the first thing that question asks is how much comedy is in it, you know? But yeah, to me, all of that means nothing without heart. So that's why I always make sure that there's plenty of that in it.
Well, that's what I really appreciate about the character of Moopoo, is that you're not afraid to create a toddler-like character that is fallible, right? Because often childlike characters in animated films and also live action as well, they can do nothing wrong, right? Or they're not, you know, they're just good characters all around because they're a toddler. Whereas here is a character who doesn't really know that they are capable of doing dangerous things. Right. That I found really quite powerful, because it's just that sense of an acknowledgement that, you know, yes, they're young, they might not really know what they're doing, but it's
but they're also not incapable. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And that makes them even more of a fully realized character and part of the world. Can you talk about the importance of that for a character like Moopoo?
Yeah, I guess the thing is, you know, like, Young audiences, they'd like to see themselves represented for a start, and I think they will find that in Moopoo. But at the same time, you don't want to have somebody who's just cute and innocent and oh, you know, like babyish, you know, because yes, babies and puppies are cute, but at the same time, you know, like Mupu, he's very inquisitive, which, you know, appeals to young kids, but also he's cheeky. And that cheekiness makes him like an imperfect character, but at the same time makes him so adorable, because you could never be angry with Mupu, right? And I think young kids in particular will see that and really, yeah, kind of admire Mupu in that way. And I think there will be a few parents who will have to endure being called Mummy Poo for a while. I've already had a couple of mothers say like, yep, thank you, you know, I've been Mummy Poo for a while now, so yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what I like as well. There is this level of, it is a childlike level of scatological humor that's in there too. Uh-huh. Obviously there's the poo part, but then there's the fart jokes, and that's kind of like a staple of animated films. And I'm curious for you then, as a director, what makes a good fart joke for a kid's film?
You know, I think, you see, I'm one of these people who think all farts are funny.
Yeah.
And I have kind of looked back, and I don't think I've ever made a movie without a fart joke in it. I don't know whether that's just my, you know, immature humor, but I think you just have to make sure it's not totally gross. You know, like I would never fart like in somebody's face and expect people to laugh, you know, like also if you combine a fart gag with an action that then propels the story or wins the day, then that's a fart gag for me that works on all levels then. Like, for example, we had a show once where these characters are all tied up really tight with a rope around a tree, and one of them farts, and the others were like, oh, come on, we can't escape, you know, like, we can't get away from you. Oh, actually, it's quite similar to this movie, but then they realize, oh, the more I fart, the more I deflate, and then the ropes become looser, and then we can get out. And so, again, you know, that was a way to make something funny, but at the same time, it actually helped our group to escape. So in this case, they managed to distract Max enough for everybody to be released from her restraining spell.
It's so good. Like, it's just, even as an adult, like, as you're saying, farts are inherently funny. And so getting to see, I think, for me, getting to see a lot of different ways that farts are presented in film make it a little bit more enjoyable as well. It's like, how are they going to employ a fart in this? And it's just, it's funny. I want to talk about the voice cast as well before we end up wrapping up. I'm curious, what's it like? You've got a huge array of different voices here, but Elias Windles is wonderful as Freddy. And I'm curious if you can talk about working with Elias here and in 100% Wolf as well.
What I love about Eli is he's very much like Freddy, the character. And I love his really unique tone of voice. He has we looked literally through hundreds of submissions in the casting process. And when I heard his voice, I just knew straight away he was the right guy. But also the thing is, Eli has a great range. He can do very sweet, emotional, heartfelt moment where he's getting himself to tears, you know. But also at the same time, he can be absolutely flamboyant and oblivious to everybody else's needs while still being, like, he's kind of, like, he acts as a very selfish character, but never really mean-spirited. And Eli really captures all these moments incredibly well. So, yeah, I was very happy to work with him again.
Yeah, and the same with Samara Weaving as well, who is always a delight.
Samara is a unique entity on her own. She's just naturally very funny, and she has a very dry and very quirky sense of humor. And I've never seen anybody come into a recording session as prepared as her. Her script looked like it has been read 100 times, and there were notes all over it. And I've never had that pleasure of working with somebody who was so prepared and really believed so much in the character that she is Batty, absolutely. So yeah, that was fantastic. And what she also does, she does ad lib really well. She adds gags along the way because of her quirky sense of humor. So yeah, that's always a plus.
So how do you add in gags and ad libs into your creative process? Like, how does it factor into the animation?
Well, in the creative process, like there's a few different ways to go about it. One is to encourage the actors during the voice records, where you always try to trigger them and then try to loosen them up by just telling jokes or explaining what their situation is like and making jokes around that. And they go, oh, I like this or this or that. And they go, yes. And so we coax it out of them, because the one thing that never works with actors or actresses is when you say like, oh, feel free to ad lib, add anything you want. They go like, come on, like, just do your job and give me the right lines, or don't expect me to be funny on the moment. And a lot of actors actually react negatively to it when you encourage them to ad lib. So there's an art to coaxing that out. But then there's also characters like Akmal, who it's almost like you have to, I spent 95% of my time discouraging him from ad-libbing, because I said, like, please, can you read the line just once? So we have the line that we've written, because his mind is incredible, that it just works like a million miles an hour. And he comes up with the craziest stuff. But before you know it, he's talking about his grandmother's recipe or oh, isn't it odd that I'm, oh, what is this squirrel, you know, or whatever. It is so scattered, but it's so funny. So you end up listening along and you're laughing, and then you realize, oh, no, shit, we actually need to work. We need to try to record the lines. And after the records, we spent hours or days really sifting through all his takes. And there's always some gold in there where you go, oh, that is a funny gag. And we worked it into the movie. So that's one side of the process, the voice recording. But also we just muck around a lot when we do animated movies in the edit, where we just throw in gags and we just act them out ourselves. We do the voices ourselves, and then we get the actors to come and say them out loud. And much better acting. but yeah, we add a lot of gags in the storyboarding process and the edit process. Yeah,
it's wonderful. Well, you've made a really, really delightful film. I'm looking forward to seeing it in cinema and just enjoying it with an audience, because it is that kind of film, yeah. Just like the first one was. That was Elias Windles and Alexis Staderman talking about their new film, 200% Wolf, which is screening at the Sydney Film Festival this coming weekend, with a theatrical release coming later in 2024. Make sure to keep track of thecurb.com.au for more screening details. Thank you all again for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.